WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook. And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you, right now, whenever that happens to be. The Healthy Planet radio show focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. This is our annual show that's on the topic that got me fully hooked into doing nonprofit health and environmental education so many decades ago. Back at that time, very few environmentalists or others knew very much about these issues that we're going to be talking about today in some depth. And I'm sorry to say that this issue has now proven to be one of the very most important environmental issues of our time. And I'm talking about how our food choices impact our environment and our health. And more specifically, how eating high on the food chain is so devastating to our ecosystem and society overall. I'm going to spend the next 55 minutes talking a lot about climate change and also a lot about the details about why eating high on the food chain is so damaging to our world. Before I do that, I want to say that on the positive side, whereas so many of the problems that we're facing don't have easy solutions, don't have something that you can just click your fingers and say, look, if we just do this, it'll be fixed. What I love about this issue is that the solutions are so easy, and they are truly solutions without a downside. And that's why, usually without fail, I devote one show each year to covering this topic. So I've been working with Healthy Planet, the nonprofit organization that my listeners know about, for a really long time. And basically, Healthy Planet is about teaching people about how our food and lifestyle choices impact our bodies and the world. One thing we don't do is tell people what to do. Because if I push you, you're going to just naturally push back. What we do is teach about the cause and effect from our actions. So if we take a certain action, it's going to cause one thing. If we take another action, it's going to cause the second thing. Depending on what your values are, you may choose A or B. That's up to you. But at least you can come away from hearing what we teach you with a full understanding of the impact that you could make depending on your choices. So before we go into other issues, as I mentioned before, we're going to talk about today's big challenge, and that is climate change. If you don't know what climate change or global warming is, that's great. Sit tight. The 101 version of climate change is it's basically the increase in the average temperature of the Earth's near surface air and oceans. And the climate change we're talking about today is that which is taking place as the result of human activities or anthropogenic climate change. This happens when we as a society take part in all kinds of activities, from driving to flying on planes to our agriculture to the way we heat our homes and cool our homes. All of this and so much more contribute to particles going into the atmosphere, climate change particles. What these particles end up doing is they form a blanket around the Earth. And this blanket has an effect on our temperatures because sunlight hits our planet, and usually, prior to human-caused climate change, most of it would get reflected back into space. But now, with this blanket of climate change gases around our planet, some of those sun rays are not reflecting back into space, but they're being trapped in our atmosphere. That's the simple explanation. Now, you might ask, is there a lot of this heat being trapped? And I'll give you one way of thinking about it. This is according to James Hansen, the former director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. He says that the energy trapped by man-made global warming pollution is now equivalent to exploding 600,000 first-generation atomic bombs per day, 365 days per year. That is a lot of excess heat. So, now you know that we're trapping an enormous amount of heat in our atmosphere. The question is, how big is our atmosphere, right? Because if the atmosphere is huge, hundreds and thousands of miles high, then really, who cares? Is it really so big that it can handle all of that heat? And to answer that question, I'm going to present you with a quiz question. This is quiz question number one. You ready? If you were to drive your car straight up in the air, of course, if you could, which is impossible, but if you were to drive your car straight up in the air at interstate highway speeds, how soon would you reach the top of the troposphere? That's the layer of our atmosphere where we dump all of our greenhouse gas pollution and where we get all of our air. How long would it take you to get there in your car, driving at 60-some miles per hour? What do you think? Is it 1 hour? 15 minutes? 3 hours? What do you think? You live on this planet too. The answer is, you would reach the end of where all that pollution and where our air is in about 5 minutes. Did you get that? 5 minutes. Another way of thinking about it is that if the Earth was modeled by a basketball, the atmosphere would be as thick as a bedsheet or a piece of plastic wrapped tightly around that basketball. So we're putting in a lot of particles of greenhouse gases in the form of carbon dioxide, in the form of methane, nitrous oxide, and a bunch of other gases. Those are the three main ones. How much are we putting in? According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration on climate.gov, we're putting in about 36 plus billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Now, that's up from about 11 billion tons in the 1960s. But if you're like me, you can't really imagine what 36 billion tons is. So, how much is 1 ton? That's about the weight of a 2015 Mitsubishi Mirage car. Now imagine, putting climate change particles in the air that weigh the equivalent of 36 billion Mitsubishi Mirage cars every single year. Even after hearing this, some of you might be asking the question, is all this carbon in the atmosphere actually causing a problem? That's the wrong question to ask. The right question to ask is, how could that not be causing a massive problem? And indeed, it is. According to an unprecedented 2017 government report that was put out during the Trump administration, I'm sure they didn't like it, but their scientists were at work. This report said, as a result of climate change, sea levels could rise by as much as 8 feet by the end of the century. They also went on to say that this period is now the warmest in modern civilization, that the CO2 is the highest in 3 million years. And they finally said that there is no convincing alternative explanation about why this is happening, aside from human-caused climate change. And we are indeed seeing the impacts. I've been doing talks like this for decades, but in 2014, I said, okay, 2014, officially the hottest year on record. 2015, also the hottest year on record. 2016, the hottest year on record. 2019, second hottest year on record. 2020, tied for the hottest year in recorded history. But looking at the bigger picture, the 9 warmest years on record all took place in the last 9 years. And looking at the bigger picture yet, 21 of the 22 hottest years on record have occurred since the year 2002. Now, the worldwide scientific organizations that hold the position that climate change has been caused by human action, basically all of them. Suffice it to say that that consensus of climate science is synopsized by a survey that was done in 2021 of 88,125 climate-related studies. This survey from the Cornell Chronicle showed that more than 99.9% of peer-reviewed scientific papers agree that climate change is mainly caused by humans. So put your doubts to rest, and when you hear that guy on some pseudo-news channel on TV telling you that it's not real, find out what their credentials are, and find out what they've published. I pretty much know the answer to that question. And big stories on climate change are really coming fast. In many cases, we only need to look out our window to see what's happening. On Long Island, we've had our epic hurricanes like Sandy, but the most recent event was the intense and really toxic smoke from the Canada wildfires that we were forced to breathe in this year. But there are extreme weather events happening all over the planet, and we can't get used to them because they're not normal. Hurricane Hillary hit the California Baja Peninsula, which never happens. The record-breaking temperatures in the South, including water temperature in Florida that hit 101 plus degrees, that's bizarre. In Libya, they think that more than 11,000 may have died as torrential downpours caused two dams to burst. Just last week, we saw in New York at John F. Kennedy Airport, we had 8.65 inches of rain in one day, a new record. In 2022, floods in Pakistan submerged one-third of the country, affecting 33 million people, half of which were children. And the wildfires that we experienced from Canada were not the only wildfires we're seeing. All over the planet, we are seeing more extensive wildfires, like California's 2018 campfire. Remember that? And the fires in Maui that ripped through wilderness and neighborhoods, destroying homes, habitat, and of course, lives, both of humans and wildlife. Drought was a factor in all of these fires, but there were also major fires in Europe, Australia, Siberia, to just name a few. I could go on for a long time talking about these once-in-a-lifetime, once-in-a-century storms. Michael, Sandy, Harvey, Dorian, Katrina, Ike, and more. These climate events are increasing in intensity and will continue to do so in the years and decades to come. These and more are why the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, made up of the world's leading climate scientists, has said, and I quote, "It's now or never to limit global warming." This was in 2022. The UN Secretary General said, and listen to this quote, "Unless governments everywhere reassess their energy policies, quote, the world will be uninhabitable," end quote. Those are pretty powerful words. And even if we hear our politicians saying otherwise, we need to really ask ourselves, what if they're not giving us the best information? Or perhaps, what if they are receiving money from parties that don't want them giving you the best information, perhaps the fossil fuel industry? A groundbreaking study from 2021 found that more than 5 million extra deaths a year can be attributed to abnormal hot and cold temperatures alone. This was the first study ever done of this topic internationally. One thing is clear, and that's that climate change-related deaths are rising, and that, unfortunately, that rise will certainly accelerate in years to come. Now, if you've heard all of this and still, for some reason, don't believe all the scientists in the world and don't believe all the studies and aren't seeing it on the news and believing what you're seeing, you can get behind what I'm going to talk about now. And that's that climate change gases do not come from unicorns and rainbows. Climate change comes with pollution. So when you see that smokestack, you know it's emitting dangerous fumes that are accompanying the climate change gases. In fact, according to the Air Quality Life Index, Energy Policy Institute at the University of Chicago, for every 1,000 people alive on Earth, 973 are regularly inhaling toxins. So only 27 out of 1,000 people on this Earth are not inhaling toxins, which means, almost certainly, you are too. They go on to say that particulate air pollution is the single greatest threat to human health globally. This air pollution is insidious. It gets into our bodies because it's so tiny, it gets into our bloodstream. How small are these particles? They're about 1/30th the width of a human hair. It's called particulate matter 2.5. How many people is it killing? Well, according to the recent research from Harvard University in collaboration with other universities, more than 8 million people died in 2018 from fossil fuel pollution. That's significantly higher than previous research suggested. Another way of looking at that is that exposure to particulate matter from fossil fuel emissions accounted for almost 1 out of 5 total global deaths in 2018. And in the United States alone, particulate pollution causes up to 360,000 deaths every single year. And newer research yet shows that these numbers may, in fact, also be underestimates. One thing we know is that air pollution is killing wide scale. And to put that number into perspective, air pollution kills more people in 1 year than COVID-19 has since it came to us in late 2019. And while I'm mentioning COVID, in an April 2020 study, the Harvard School of Public Health found that counties that have more polluted air will experience higher risks of death from COVID-19. So what does all this have to do with what we eat? Well, usually when we think of deadly air pollution, quite rightly, we think of images of smokestacks and motor vehicles. But according to a 2016 study published in Geophysical Research Letters, emissions from farms, that's right, farms, outweigh all other human sources of this fine particulate air pollution in much of the US, Europe, China, and Russia. The main source of this particulate pollution from farms is fumes, mainly in the form of ammonia. These fumes combine in the air with industrial emissions to form this deadly PM2.5. So where does that ammonia come from? Well, according to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, 64% of human-induced ammonia emissions come from the livestock sector. And again, the results in solid particles formed at PM2.5 are a huge source of disease and death. So when you think deadly air pollution particles, in addition to smoke that comes from snacks and cars, you need to think of the ammonia from the cows you eat and that tiny particulate pollution that it forms. You're listening to WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. This is the Healthy Planet radio show, and I am Bob DiBenedetto. We're talking about one of the most important things you can do to save the environment, save our climate, and do some good for your body. There are a couple of really scary stories in the world of climate change. And if you're just listening to the news every day, you're not necessarily going to hear these reflected upon. So I'll mention a couple of them. One, according to the World Glacier Monitoring Service, as reported by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, 2022 was the 35th year in a row that glaciers were lost rather than gained. And that caused the World's Glacier Monitoring Service to say that most glaciers are shrinking or disappearing. They go on to say that we've lost 90 feet off the top of glaciers since 1970. We can look in all different countries, and we see that the pace of the glacier loss has accelerated since the 1980s. Whether the glaciers are in Switzerland, Peru, Alaska, Italy, or India or China, we see that areas that once had massive glaciers are now sometimes clear of glaciers. So isn't that a good thing? Isn't it great to get rid of all those frozen glaciers? What's so important about glaciers anyway? What's important about glaciers will be revealed in quiz question number 2. And that is, what percentage of the Earth's fresh water do you think is stored in glaciers? The answer, according to the U.S. Geological Survey, is about 3/4 of our fresh water is stored in glaciers. That means that as the glaciers are disappearing, our stores of fresh water are also disappearing. The fact that so much of our water is stored in glaciers makes the shocking findings from a landmark report about the Hindu Kush Himalaya region all the more alarming. This was a study done by over 200 scientists over the course of 5 years. What they found is that glaciers in this Hindu Kush region provide water to 250 million people via rivers that flow into India, Pakistan, China, and other nations. They also found that 1.65 billion people rely on the rivers from these glaciers for farming and other uses. 1.65 billion people. Here's the shocking part. This report concluded that even if carbon emissions are dramatically and rapidly cut, 36% of these glaciers in that region along the Himalaya range will be gone by 2100. And if emissions are not cut, the losses soar to 2/3 of the glaciers being lost by 2100. Either scenario results in serious consequences for almost 2 billion people. So what happens when there's not enough drinking water? Well, you can't stay where you are. People have to leave their homes. So is it a problem when desperate people leave their homes and country in search of a place where they and their families can actually just survive? For the answer to that question, we only need to look as far as our southern border. While a few million immigrants are turned away from our borders each year, the number of refugees admitted are measured in the tens to hundreds of thousands over the years. So what would be the global impact of up to 2 billion climate refugees? Well, if you look at the total populations of Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, you'd see that their entire populations are only roughly 160 million people. So what would be the global impact of 2 billion climate refugees? And here's the difference between our refugee situation and the refugee situation that would be occurring in the Hindu Kush region, is that we're friends with Mexico and the countries down south. And we are the wealthiest country on the planet. In the Hindu Kush region, these countries do not love each other. India and China, India and Pakistan. So when we have billions of refugees moving from country to country, the results are entirely unpredictable and definitively destabilizing of the world order. So something needs to be done. And as a footnote, those melting glaciers pose another threat to our world, and that is as a major cause of rising sea levels in recent decades. And as you may know, sea level rise is a major problem that we're increasingly being forced to deal with. According to NOAA, again, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, sea levels have risen between 8 and 9 inches since 1880. What's alarming, too, is that the rate of sea level rise more than doubled from 2006 to 2015, compared to the rate throughout most of the 20th century. And this leads us to very scary story number 2. A 2019 study looked at sea level rise, and they found that sea level rise was much worse than estimated. They found that even with moderate cuts in emissions, by 2100, 300 million people could be displaced because of rising seas. We're talking about the equivalent of 90% of the population of the United States. They also found that the cost of sea level rise could be in the tens of trillions of dollars per year. Just to give you an example of how bad it is, southern Vietnam, including Saigon, will be largely submerged at points during the year by 2050, according to this new data. So we've seen enough to know that we need to act now, and we can't wait for our government. In fact, as we're creating this show, despite the extreme health damage that results from polluted air, some in our government are actually working against the Clean Air Act. House Republicans are behind a push to put an end to states' personalized efforts to cut tailpipe pollution with their bill, H.R. 1435. Instead of stating the truth that this bill would cost us lives and contribute to the instability of our climate for future generations and for us today, they label it with misleading euphemisms, such as Preserving Choice in Vehicle Purchase Act. Or they say it's the act to prevent the elimination of the internal combustion engine. And this is so important since passenger cars and trucks are responsible for 57% of the transportation sector's total climate pollution and are a leading cause of the smog and other health-harming pollution that we talked about a few minutes ago. So in a perfect world, waiting for our government might work, depending on who's in power, but it also might fail miserably. Just a few short years ago, an American president, Donald Trump, set out to destroy so many of our environmental protections and actually named a coal lobbyist as the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. And if you were to read the energy policies of Mike Pence or Ron DeSantis, both running for president, you would think that you were living in the 1950s, where climate change didn't exist, and where toxic air was a given, versus today, where we have more awareness and better, cleaner, cheaper technology. It is indeed mind-boggling to read these energy policies. I had a politician knock at my door probably about a month ago. And she was telling me about the things that she's accomplished and wants to do. I said, "What do you think about climate change?" She said something to the effect that, "Well, it's unclear." I cut her off right there. I said, "You are a leader, but a leader is someone who leads. A leader is someone who finds out the truth and tells their constituency regardless of what their constituency wants to hear from them. You're in a position of power, and you have not educated yourself on one of the defining issues of our time, climate change. Because you know what? You've got it wrong. It's not uncertain at all. And I went on to tell her about some of the issues that I've been mentioning thus far in this program. She apologized and said, "I promise to look into it more." She picked the wrong house, but I am sure glad that she did come to my house. So since I can't wait for the governance, I ask myself, what can I do to have the biggest impact on climate change? And while I'm not perfect, I do my very best to live what I teach. In every way possible that I can think of, I use a low-flow shower head, I reuse my bags, I recycle everything, I don't use plastic bottles, I use all LED bulbs, which save about 90% of the energy from incandescents. I use clean products for construction, for cleaning, for personal grooming. And in the winter, when it's a little bit chilly, first I put a sweatshirt on and sweatpants before I raise my thermostat. And that can have a big impact. But one of the other things I've done in my home is that I no longer use fossil fuel heating and cooling. How is that possible? Well, I use the sun. First, I use solar panels, which creates all of our electricity. And second, I use those solar panels to run my geothermal heating and cooling system. The geothermal heating and cooling system takes the heat and coolness from the earth, and it circulates it to heat and cool the home. I also use a heat pump hot water heater, which is much more efficient, and that runs off of our solar panels. And we have an electric car that doesn't use gas, and that too is charged from our solar panels. So, I'm doing everything I can think of and trying to lead the way for you and for anyone else who I happen to talk to about this. But there's another big solution that I take part in that requires no cash outlay and no waiting. Because all of the things I told you, you have to spend a little money now. You have to buy an electric car. You have to pay for the geothermal. You have to pay for the solar panels, even though they pay you back starting in the first month. There's another solution. What is it? Well, quiz question number 3 is going to tell us what that is. Which creates more climate change gases? Is it all the cars in the world? All the trucks? All the boats? All the trains? All the planes? Or all the cows in the world? What do you think? The answer is that according to a recent analysis from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations and leading researchers, it's estimated that livestock accounted for between 11 and almost 20% of all greenhouse gas production. That means that livestock emit way more greenhouse gases than any of those forms of transportation alone. And by most estimates, more than all forms of transportation combined. It creates so much that if cattle were a country, that country would rank 3rd in greenhouse gas emissions behind China and the United States. It's worth noting that 30% of the Earth's land is used to either raise farmed animals or to grow food crops to feed these animals. So if all or part of that land was restored to ecological health, it would create a massive carbon sink, capturing and storing carbon that otherwise would have been added to climate change. This is not reflected in some of the official figures about livestock's contribution to total greenhouse gases. New research reported in the journal PLOS Climate said that if the world were to end all meat and dairy production and transition to a plant-based food system over the next 15 years, it would prevent enough greenhouse gas emissions to effectively cancel out emissions from all other economic sectors for the next 30 to 50 years. That's how great the contribution of livestock is to the problem of climate change. If we look at the 3 main climate change gases, CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide, we look at CO2 first, and we see that 3/4 of a gallon of oil is used to create 1 pound of beef. Livestock overall puts out about 375 billion pounds of carbon per year. If we look at methane, somewhere between 32 and 44% of all human-induced methane comes from livestock. And methane is very important because it's 25 to 100 times more powerful than CO2 in trapping heat in our atmosphere. To put this into perspective, a single cow can produce 132 gallons of methane a day. That's as much methane as it would take to fill my previous gas-driven car with methane 9 times. And that's from one cow every day. And the third major climate change gas is nitrous oxide. That's 300 times more powerful than CO2 in trapping heat in the atmosphere. And about 53% of all human-related nitrous oxide comes from livestock. So the issue is what we eat. But why is this the issue? How could this be such a big issue? And for that answer, you need to look at how many of these animals there are on our planet. There are about 1.5 billion cattle, 1.3 billion pigs, buffalo, horses, etc., 22 billion chicken, etc. Suffice it to say that these beautiful animals outweigh us, they outnumber us, and they outpoop us, which creates an enormous source of water pollution in this country. And when you realize how many there are and how much they eat, it won't surprise you that 41% of U.S. land is there to feed livestock. That's between pasture and feed crops that are grown to feed animals. So most food grown in the U.S. is fed to animals, not people. And the damage is global. Climate change and air pollution are not our only challenges. All of these billions of animals using so much of our lands use a lot of water. And this is in a world where over 2 billion people live in countries experiencing water stress. In fact, by 2040, 1 in 4 children will be living in areas of extremely high water stress. That's according to UNICEF in 2021. So let's give you another quiz question here. Which one sector, according to the Pacific Institute study in 2012, which one sector used 47% of California's total water footprint? Is it all the lawns, all of the industry, all of the almonds, or all of the livestock? Which is it? And the answer is, the cattle in California used more than 47% of all the water used for all purposes in that state. Why is that? Because California creates a lot of dairy products. And dairy products require a lot of dairy cows, and dairy cows drink a lot of water, and dairy cows require a lot of food to be eaten over the course of their lifetime. That requires a lot of water. And while Californians were being told to moderate their home use of water in order to protect water resources, which is great, which I do too, the truth was that only 4% of California's total water footprint was associated with direct household water consumption, like landscape irrigation or flushing your toilet. On the other hand, more than 90% of California's water footprint was used for agricultural products, with, again, meat and dairy products alone accounting for 47% of all the water use. According to the University of California Alfalfa Working Group, milk itself is a rather water-intensive commodity, requiring, according to their data, 683 gallons to create just 1 gallon of milk. And it's not just dairy that requires so much water. If we look at tomatoes, potatoes, we see that it takes about 26 to 35 gallons of water to make a pound of edible produce. Wheat takes about 219 gallons of water to make 1 edible pound. Contrast that with grain-fed beef. We see that it takes 1,850 gallons of water to make a pound of edible beef. That's as much water as it would take to take a 5-minute shower every other day using 2 gallons per minute for an entire year. So if you were looking to save water, cut out 1 pound of beef from your diet in the course of a year, or stop showering for an entire year. You're listening to Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet radio show on WUSB 90.1 FM. And we're talking about the impact of what you eat on the climate and our world. So we've covered the impact of livestock raising, that is the meat that we eat, on climate change, on our water supply, and on pollution. But it's also the rainforests. Rainforests are an amazing resource that contain 80% of the world's land's vegetation. A lot of our oxygen supply comes from the rainforest. A quarter of our medicines come from rainforest raw materials. And ancient indigenous people still live in the rainforest, not to mention almost half of all animal and bird species on our planet. But since 1990, the world has lost the equivalent of 1,000 football fields of forests per hour. Every hour, 1,000 football fields of forests, according to the World Wildlife Federation and the Zoological Society of London. The Amazon rainforest lost an area the size of Israel in 2020. Why? Well, according to Mongabay in 2019, 65 to 70% of the Amazon rainforest lands is cleared for grazing animals. But obviously, it's not the fault of these beautiful, gentle creatures who we raise to eat. But they are large creatures, and they eat a lot, and their hooves, and their waists, and their appetites all wreak havoc on our lands. And this is also true of the grazing lands in the United States. If you look at a before and after picture of a large part of the United States, one-third of all the lands in the United States is grazed by cattle, you see that before grazing, those lands were vibrant ecosystems. Water flowed through them, fish were in the water, animals lived in the grasses, birds lived in the trees, and there was a wide variety of vegetation. However, when you see areas post-grazing, you see stream beds that have been trampled. You see the plant life growing on the sides of the streams is gone, eaten and trampled. And that takes away the habitat for animals and birds. Now, the killing of all these plant and animal species is a big deal. Because according to the 2018 World Wildlife Federation and Zoological Society of London report, we're in the middle of a mass extinction event. In May of 2019, the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity, made up of about 150 authors from 50 nations working for 3 years, compiled a report. Their panel was made up of 132 member nations, including the United States. This report stated that while we might think that a mass species extinction might only impact the Earth's wildlife, their report suggests that the decimation of the natural world at the hands of human consumption is in fact also threatening human existence worldwide. Their extensive report stated that the accelerating rate of extinctions means grave impacts on people around the world are now likely, and that the self-imposed loss of biodiversity is eroding the foundations of our economies, livelihoods, food security, health, and quality of life. They went on to say that this report shows that nature is collapsing around us. It's a real wake-up call to humanity. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations stated that, quote, "The livestock sector may well be the leading player in the reduction of biodiversity, since it is the major driver of deforestation, as well as one of the leading drivers of land degradation, pollution, climate change, overfishing, sedimentation of coastal areas, and facilitation of invasions by alien species," end quote. The chief of the indigenous Brazilian Kayapa people made a statement that pretty much echoes what the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity stated. And that quote is as follows. "For many years, we, the indigenous leaders and peoples of the Amazon, have been warning you, our brothers, who have brought so much damage to our forests. What you are doing will change the whole world and will destroy our home, and it will destroy your home too." End quote. You're listening to WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. This is Bob DiBenedetto with The Healthy Planet, talking about the impact of our food choices on our world and our bodies. In June of 2018, the most comprehensive analysis to date of the damage farming does to the planet was done. The study from Oxford University, published in the journal Science, created a huge database of almost 40,000 farms in 119 countries, covering food that represents 90% of all the food that's eaten on our planet. And what they found most likely will surprise you, and that is that 83% of the world's farmlands is used to raise livestock. And all of that farmland, 83%, produces just 18% of our calories. The lead author of this study, a gentleman by the name of Joseph Poor, said the following, quote, "A vegan diet is probably the single biggest way to reduce your impact on planet Earth." He continues by saying, "I have stopped consuming animal products over the last 4 years of this project," end quote. Now, Joseph Poor, a lead researcher at Oxford University, did what I think a lot of people will do once they can really internalize the damage that's being done by livestock. And that is, he took action in his personal life. So why is raising animals to eat so wasteful? It's pretty simple. If we have 8 billion people to feed, let's just say for simplification, we do one of two options. One is we feed people without feeding them meat. And two, we feed people with meat. If we feed people without meat, then we raise the food on the land, we eat that food, and that's the end of the equation. If we eat meat instead of eating the food that directly grows from the land, we need to raise food to feed the animals, and then we eat those animals. When we do that, when we pass our food through animals in order to create food for us, we end up wasting 90% of the calories, 90% of the protein, and 100% of the fiber that's in the food that grows from the ground. Lost. The simple solution, as I mentioned in the beginning of this show, is to stop using a middleman so much. So instead of feeding the food to animals and then eating the animals, eat the food directly from the ground, which are the best foods for us. If we do that, we either can create a whole lot more food on all of that land, or we can create enough food to feed our people and have a lot of land that can go back to nature. And when I say go back to nature, I mean lands that could be used to create fresh water, that will be a carbon sink, that will create oxygen, that will create wildlife habitat, that will create areas for humans to enjoy. The University of Oxford study went on to say that if the world stopped eating meat and dairy, global farmland use could be reduced by more than 75%. And yes, we could still feed the world. So does it matter? Do we really need all this land? Do we need more food? Or can we just go along and keep eating the standard American diet? The answer to that is that according to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations in 2022, 735 million people faced hunger. And yet every hour of every day, Americans eat about 1 million animals. And in 2021, according to the World Health Organization, over 6,000 children under 5 years old died every day from malnutrition. This is not an acceptable situation. This is not something that any of us would allow to happen if we had the ability to snap our fingers and say, we need to go in a different direction. An article in the Global Times last year covered an issue that applied just what we're talking about now to the food crisis that we've been facing as a result of the Ukraine war and the attack by Russia. They quoted an article in the Nature Food Journal at China Agricultural University, as well as two experts from the Netherlands. It was entitled, "Adoption of Plant-Based Diets Across Europe Can Improve Food Resilience Against the Russia-Ukraine Conflict." According to this article, when crises related to extreme weather events, COVID-19, and the Russia-Ukraine conflict have revealed serious problems in global food interdependency, and a transition toward planetary health diet will help. The report said that if the European Union and the United Kingdom reduced meat consumption 20%, the saved crops could replace most crops exported by Ukraine and Russia and would yield a considerable environmental dividend. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, how much do we as a global community really care about the ongoing food crisis? Why aren't governments putting forth the solution that we can collectively move toward eating more plants and less meat to at least temporarily alleviate the pressure on our food system? You're listening to The Healthy Planet on WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook. Let me say a couple of words about COVID-19, because this is closely tied into our raising of animals for food. That'll be quiz question number 4. According to the Centers for Disease Control, where do 75% of all new and emerging diseases come from? The answer is animals. Zoonotic diseases. If you look at the worst epidemics in history, and we're talking about everything from Marburg to Ebola to SARS to the H5N1 bird flu to MERS to HIV to, yes, even the seasonal flu, that came originally from chickens. What they all have in common is that they were passed along from animals to people. Someone may have eaten that animal. Someone might have slaughtered the animal. Someone might have gotten the blood of the animal on them or into their mucous membranes. And that transferred whatever the virus was in that animal species to humans. Now, of course, we know that the source of COVID-19 is uncertain. That it's still being debated. Did it come from a lab? Did it come from an animal? But one thing we do know is that historically, over the last 100 years, the vast majority of all of these diseases have come from animals. So we need to start practicing social distancing. I'm talking about social distancing with animals. We need to stop confining them and slaughtering them. We need to stop destroying their homes in nature and changing the climate, forcing them to leave their natural homes. That kind of social distancing will not only stop us from spreading the disease, but from getting it into the human population in the first place. You know, we've talked about all of these issues in some depth, but all I had to do really is quote a big report from the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization called Livestock's Long Shadow. In that report, they say, and I quote, "The livestock sector emerges as one of the top 2 or 3 most significant contributors to the most serious environmental problems at every scale, from local to global," end quote. But this devastation is not only happening on land, it's happening in the ocean. Trillions of fish are killed every year, and fisheries are being depleted at a very dangerous pace. A lot of the 160 billion pounds of fish that we catch don't go to people. A lot of them go, number one, to bycatch, where it's just thrown away immediately after they catch it, because it's not the fish they were looking for. Oh, we don't want these turtles, dolphins, whales, sharks, seals, real fish, birds, etc. So we throw those away. But also a large percentage of everything that we catch is fed to animals, like fish, pigs, and chicken, cycled through those animals so that we can eat those animals. So we're wasting a lot of the fish that we catch out at sea. We are killing trillions of fish every year, and what a waste it is. And all of that fishing, by the way, as I mentioned in the last show, is creating an enormous amount of plastics pollution in the ocean. Because ghost fishing gear, that stuff that they lose, the nets that break, etc., represents a large portion of the plastics that are polluting our oceans. As I mentioned at the beginning of this show, what I really love about this problem, sounds weird, but this problem is so easy to handle because the solution is not only something that's going to help the environment, but the same solution that's best for the environment is best for our bodies. Because eating so much meat and dairy is, we know now, entirely unnecessary. And this is according to the world's largest organization of food and nutrition professionals, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. They say that appropriately planned vegan diets are healthful, nutritionally adequate, and may provide health benefits for the prevention and treatment of certain diseases. And we talk about a vegan diet, but basically what we're saying is that the more we move on the continuum from the standard American diet, which is heavy in meat and dairy products, to the vegan diet that has no animal products in it, the better it is going to be for our health and for the planet. One of my favorite stories here is from 2019. when 30 world-leading scientists from across the globe put together the first full scientific review of what would constitute what they called a planetary health diet. They said this diet would prevent 11 million deaths a year and avoid climate change. This is called the Eat Lancet Commission on Food, Planet, Health. Do you know what they said would be required of North Americans to eat in accordance with what they called a planetary health diet? They said North Americans would need to eat 84% less red meat. And in 2018, Harvard scientists calculated that if everyone moved to a vegetarian diet, that move alone would prevent at least one-third of early deaths. And that's from Dr. Walter Willett, one of the world's preeminent epidemiologists, and he's the professor of nutrition and epidemiology at Harvard Medical School. Now, if you look at the connection between disease and what we eat, let's look at the American Institute for Cancer Research, which is the go-to organization that connects lifestyle and cancer. They say that about one-third of cancers could be reduced by cutting out tobacco and smoking. They also say another third could be reduced by looking at our diet and cutting back on obesity. And you know what they said were the foods that fight cancer? There's a whole chart of more than 25 foods. And do you know what's on that chart? I'll tell you what's not on it. Meat, dairy, eggs, fish, chicken. None of that is on the chart. It's all foods that grow from the grounds. The greens, the blueberries, the grapes, the kale, the cranberries, even coffee. Cauliflower, apples, asparagus, broccoli and cruciferous vegetables, Brussels sprouts, carrots. I could go on and on. But basically, what we're talking about is the food that grows from the ground in as unprocessed a state as possible. So if we're not eating all these meats and all these dairy products and all these eggs, what can we possibly eat? There's so much. I have a smoothie every day, almost every day. And in that smoothie, I probably get as much of the vital, whole plant, wholesome nutrition as most people get in a good part of their eating for the rest of the day. Because it includes a plethora of greens and lettuces and dark leafy greens. It contains nuts and seeds and berries and all the things that are the best for you. And it turns into, when you put it with delicious fruits, it turns into a smoothie that you would not trade taste-wise for any other breakfast on the planet. It's entirely nutritious and entirely delicious. But you don't have to have smoothies. In the morning, you could have oatmeals and berries and soy milk and nuts and seeds. You can have fruits like strawberries and kiwis and apples and pears and every other kind of delicious fruit that's out there. For lunch, we could have wraps. And these wraps can contain beans and hummus and lettuces and avocados, grilled vegetables. We can have all kinds of whole grain noodles and breads and salads. We can make delicious sandwiches with things like hummus and guacamole and tofu. Yeah, if you know how to make tofu, it's really delicious. I've been eating it for decades. And at this point in time, we don't even need to forego meat-like substitutes. There are so many veggie burgers, plant-based burgers out on the market. Some of them are better for you than others, like the entirely plant-based ones, like the California burgers, the organic Dr. Prager burgers. But there are also all the other burgers that taste a whole lot like meat. And if you eat them on occasion, they're not going to cause a health problem compared to eating the meat that you would have been eating on a regular basis, which is indeed increasing your risk of cancer, heart disease, and a variety of other chronic degenerative diseases. And the great thing about the plant-based foods that are becoming very, very popular is that the nutritional contents that they are made up of today will be getting better year after year because they can evolve. There's nothing set. The bottom line is there are so many plant-based foods. All you have to do is Google Whole Foods plant-based nutrition or recipes online, and you will never be wanting for incredibly delicious, nutritious foods and recipes. So if you hear all of this and you say, well, this is great, I understand the problem, but my family has always eaten differently, but my nationality, my ethnicity has eaten this kind of food forever, but my friends eat a different way, but I'm used to this, it's time to get off of our butts. And after hearing all of this, do you know what it makes you if you decide to do nothing today to really make a difference? It makes you human. And I say that because humans don't always like change, and it's not always easy to institute the change that we think the world needs. Be gentle on yourself. Continue to research this and think about it. Make a small change every day, and don't judge yourself. And if you're thinking, why bother? How can I possibly make a difference? I'm going to tell you that the world is now onto this, and you are not alone. When we used to give this talk, nobody knew what we were talking about. Now you'll see it everywhere from the Financial Times to the New York Times. You hear it in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, where the head of that organization says, please eat less meat. Meat is a very carbon-intensive commodity. In 2018, the trend of the year was a rapid consumer shift to plant-based foods. And that's from no less than Baum & Whiteman, the U.S.'s leading food and restaurant consultant. Investors managing trillions of dollars are putting the fast food giants under fire because they want them to act on climate change and water usage. We see plant-based foods talked about on the Financial Channel. And we see our politicians and our pop stars and our athletes, many of them moving toward an entirely plant-based diet. And we're talking about people like Senator Cory Booker, Mayor Eric Adams, who we've interviewed on this show, Al Gore, of course, Joaquin Phoenix, Greta Thunberg, athletes such as the surfer Tia Blanco, NBA players Kyrie Irving and Chris Paul, members of the Tennessee Titans NFL football team. How about Venus and Serena Williams? How about Novak Djokovic, who just won his 24th Grand Slam singles title? Or snowboarder Nikki Kelly? These people all eat a vegan diet. And there are musicians, such as the Black Eyed Peas frontman and rapper will.i.am, Moby, Wu-Tang's RZA, Ariana Grande, No Doubt bass player Tony Kanal, Billie Eilish, Lizzo, Katy Perry, and so many more. And then actors, from Pamela Anderson to Alicia Silverstone, Peter Dinklage, Jerome Floyd, Natalie Portman, Woody Harrelson, Zac Efron, and so many more. The bottom line is, the world has caught on and the word is out. Moving away from animals and toward plants to sustain our bodies is best for our bodies and the world. And now I'll quote someone who we all revere as being a great thinker, Albert Einstein. He said, "Nothing will benefit human health and increase the chances for survival of life on Earth as much as the evolution to a vegetarian diet." Albert Einstein was a vegetarian. His successor, Edward Witten, also a vegetarian. Edward Witten's most famous protege, Brian Greene, vegetarian. So why were so many great thinkers throughout history also vegetarians? I'm talking about Nikola Tesla, Leonardo da Vinci, Thomas Edison, Sir Isaac Newton, Mohandas Gandhi, Albert Schweitzer. And the answer to that is, from my perspective, they looked at the big picture. And people who think outside of the box are not so constrained by social norms. They actually think about the issues. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this show, they thought about the cause and the effect. You know now, after hearing all this, the effects of your food choices on the world and your bodies. Now you can make a choice. And I would recommend you put on your big mind, like Albert Einstein did, and look to have your actions eventually in alignment with your values. And that'll do it for this evening's show. This is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet radio show on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. I'll be with you again at this same time on Friday, October 20th, and thereafter on the first and third Fridays of each month at 6 p.m. For more info on Healthy Planet and our radio shows, email us at info@healthyplanetusa. You can also visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org and like our Facebook page, which is at Healthy Planet USA. Until next time, stay strong, relax, make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak up for what's right. Be kind to those around you, including our amazing four or multi-legged friends. Consider what action you might take at your next meal to address the environmental challenges of our times. Share this information with your friends and family. And finally, remember to enjoy each moment of existence on this beautiful planet that we all share. Good night.
I love this song!
I love nachos.
Loving everything? You might be buzzed.
You know what I'd love? A ride when it's time to head out.
If you see a buzz warning sign, call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand?
You hold my hand!
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.